Willkommen bei Audible. Gute Unterhaltung.
Chapter 1 of An Iron Will by Orison Swett Marden, assisted by Abner Bailey. Chapter 1. Training the Will. The education of the will is the object of our existence, says Emerson. Nor is this putting it too strongly if we take into account the human will in its relations to the divine. This accords with the saying of J. Stuart Mill that a character is a completely fashioned will. In respect to mere mundane relations, the development and discipline of one's willpower is of supreme moment in relation to success in life. No man can ever estimate the power of will. It is a part of the divine nature, all of a piece with the power of creation. We speak of God's fiat. Fiat lux, let light be. Man has his fiat. The achievements of history have been the choices, the determinations, the creations of the human will. It was the will, quiet or pugnacious, gentle or grim, of men like Wilberforce and Garrison, Goodyear and Cyrus Field, Bismarck and Grant, that made them indomitable. They simply would do what they planned. Such men can no more be stopped than the sun can be, or the tide. Most men fail, not through lack of education or agreeable personal qualities, but from lack of dogged determination, from lack of dauntless will. It is impossible, says Sharman, quote, to look into the conditions under which the battle of life is being fought, without perceiving how much really depends upon the extent to which the willpower is cultivated, strengthened, and made operative in right directions. End quote. Young people need to go into training for it. We live in an age of athletic meets. Those who are determined to have athletic willpower must take for it the kind of exercise they need. This is well illustrated by a report I have seen of the long race from Marathon in the recent Olympian Games, which was won by the young Greek peasant Sotirios Loues. A struggle in the race of life. There had been no great parade about the training of this champion runner. From his work at the plough, he quietly betook himself to the task of making Greece victorious before the assembled strangers from every land. He was known to be a good runner, and without fuss or bustle he entered himself as a competitor. But it was not his speed alone, outdistancing every rival, that made the young Greek stand out from among his fellows that day. When he left his cottage home at Amarousi, his father said to him, "Sotiri, you must only return a victor." The light of a firm resolve shone in the young man's eye. The old father was sure that his boy would win, and so he made his way to the station, there to wait till Sotiri should come in ahead of all the rest. No one knew the old man and his three daughters as they elbowed their way through the crowd. When at last the excitement of the assembled multitude told that the critical moment had arrived, that the racers were nearing the goal, the old father looked up through eyes that were a little dim, as he realized that truly Sotiri was leading the way. He was returning a victor. How the crowd surged about the young peasant when the race was fairly won! Wild with excitement, they knew not how to shower upon him sufficient praise. Ladies overwhelmed him with flowers and rings, some even gave him their watches, and one American lady bestowed upon him her jewelled smelling bottle. The princes embraced him, and the king himself saluted him in military fashion. But the young Sotirios was seeking for other praise than theirs. Past the ranks of royalty and fair maidenhood, past the outstretched hands of his own countrymen, past the applauding crowd of foreigners, his gaze wandered till it fell upon an old man, trembling with eagerness, who resolutely pushed his way through the excited, satisfied throng. Then the young face lighted, and as old Loues advanced to the innermost circle with arms outstretched to embrace his boy, the young victor said simply,
You see, Father, I have obeyed.
Mental discipline. The athlete trains for his race, and the mind must be put into training if one will win life's race. It is, says Professor Matthews, quote, only by continued strenuous efforts, repeated again and again, day after day, week after week, and month after month, that the ability can be acquired to fasten the mind to one subject, however abstract or knotty, to the exclusion of everything else. The process of obtaining this self-mastery, this complete command of one's mental powers, is a gradual one, its length varying with the mental constitution of each person, but its acquisition is worth infinitely more than the utmost labour it ever costs. End quote. Perhaps the most valuable result of all education, it was said by Professor Huxley, quote, is the ability to make yourself do the thing you have to do when it ought to be done, whether you like it or not. It is the first lesson which ought to be learned, and however early a man's training begins, it is probably the last lesson which he learns thoroughly. End quote. Doing things once. When Henry Ward Beecher was asked how it was that he could accomplish so much more than other men, he replied, quote, I don't do more, but less than other people. They do all their work three times over, once in anticipation, once in actuality, once in rumination. I do mine in actuality alone, doing it once instead of three times. End quote. This was by the intelligent exercise of Mr. Beecher's willpower in concentrating his mind upon what he was doing at a given moment and then turning to something else. Anyone who has observed businessmen closely has noticed this characteristic. One of the secrets of a successful life is to be able to hold all of our energies upon one point, to focus all of the scattered rays of the mind upon one place or thing. Centralizing force. The mental reservoir of most people is like a leaky dam which we sometimes see in the country, where the greater part of the water flows out without going over the wheel and doing the work of the mill. The habit of mind-wandering, of worrying about this and that. Quote, genius, that power which dazzles mortal eyes, is oft but perseverance in disguise. End quote. Many a man would have been a success had he connected his fragmentary efforts. Spasmodic, disconnected attempts without concentration, uncontrolled by any fixed idea, will never bring success. It is continuity of purpose alone that achieves results. Learning to swim. The way to learn to run is to run. The way to learn to swim is to swim. The way to learn to develop willpower is by the actual exercise of willpower in the business of life. The man that exercises his will, says an English essayist, quote, makes it a stronger and more effective force in proportion to the extent to which such exercise is intelligently and perseveringly maintained. End quote. The forth-putting of willpower is a means of strengthening willpower. The will becomes strong by exercise. To stick to a thing till you are master is a test of intellectual discipline and power. Dr. Cuyler. It is astonishing, says Dr. Theodore Cuyler, quote, how many men lack this power of holding on until they reach the goal. They can make a sudden dash, but they lack grit. They are easily discouraged. They get on as long as everything goes smoothly, but when there is friction, they lose heart. They depend on stronger personalities for their spirit and strength. They lack independence or originality. They only dare to do what others do. They do not step boldly from the crowd and act fearlessly. End quote. The big trees. What is needed by him who would succeed in the highest degree possible is careful planning. He is to accumulate reserved power, that he may be equal to all emergencies. Thomas Starr King said that the great trees of California gave him his first impression of the power of reserve. Quote, "It was the thought of the reserve energies that had been compacted into them," he said, "that stirred me. The mountains had given them their iron and rich stimulants. The hills had given them their soil. The clouds had given their rain and snow, and a thousand summers and winters had poured forth their treasures about their vast roots." End quote. No young man can hope to do anything above the commonplace who has not made his life a reservoir of power on which he can constantly draw, which will never fail him in any emergency. Be sure that you have stored away in your powerhouse the energy, the knowledge, that will be equal to the great occasion when it comes. "If I were 20 and had but 10 years to live," said a great scholar and writer, quote, "I would spend the first 9 years accumulating knowledge and getting ready for the 10th. End quote. I will. There are no two words in the English language which stand out in bolder relief, like kings upon a checkerboard, to so great an extent as the words I will. There is strength, depth, and solidity, decision, confidence, and power, determination, vigour, and individuality in the round, ringing tone which characterizes its delivery. It talks to you of triumph over difficulties, of victory in the face of discouragement, of will to promise and strength to perform, of lofty and daring enterprise, of unfettered aspirations, and of the thousand and one solid impulses by which man masters impediments in the way of progression. As one has well said, quote, "He who is silent is forgotten. He who does not advance falls back. He who stops is overwhelmed, distanced, crushed. He who ceases to become greater becomes smaller. He who leaves off gives up. The stationary is the beginning of the end. It precedes death. To live is to achieve, to will without ceasing." End quote. Be thou a hero. Let thy might tramp on eternal snows its way, and through the ebon walls of night hew down a passage unto day. Park Benjamin. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of An Iron Will by Orison Swett Marden, assisted by Abner Bailey. The Rulers of Destiny. There is no chance, no destiny, no fate can circumvent or hinder or control the firm resolve of a determined soul. Gifts count for nothing. Will alone is great. All things give way before it soon or late. What obstacle can stay the mighty force of the sea-seeking river in its course, or cause the ascending orb of day to wait? Each well-born soul must win what it deserves. Let the fool prate of luck. The fortunate is he whose earnest purpose never swerves, whose slightest action or inaction serves the one great aim. Ella Wheeler Wilcox. There is always room for a man of force. Emerson. The king is the man who can. Carlyle. A strong, defiant purpose is many-handed, and lays hold of whatever is near that can serve it. It has a magnetic power that draws to itself whatever is kindred. T. T. Munger. What is willpower, looked at in a large way, but energy of character? Energy of will, self-originating force, is the soul of every great character. Where it is, there is life. Where it is not, there is faintness, helplessness, and despondency.
Let it be your first study to teach the world that you are not wood and straw, that there is some iron in you. Men who have left their mark upon the world have been men of great and prompt decision. The achievements of willpower are almost beyond computation. Scarcely anything seems impossible to the man who can will strongly enough and long enough. One talent with a will behind it will accomplish more than 10 without it, as a thimbleful of powder in a rifle, the bore of whose barrel will give it direction, will do greater execution than a carload burned in the open air. The wills, the won'ts, and the can'ts. There are three kinds of people in the world, says a recent writer, quote, the wills, the won'ts, and the can'ts. The first accomplish everything, the second oppose everything, the third fail in everything. End quote. The shores of fortune, as Foster says, are covered with the stranded wrecks of men of brilliant ability, but who have wanted courage, faith, and decision, and have therefore perished in sight of more resolute but less capable adventurers who succeeded in making port. Were I called upon to express in a word the secret of so many failures among those who started out with high hopes, I should say they lacked willpower. They could not half will. And what is a man without a will? He is like an engine without steam. Genius unexecuted is no more genius than a bushel of acorns in a forest of oaks. Will has been called the spinal column of personality. The will in its relation to life, says an English writer, quote, may be compared at once to the rudder and to the steam engine of a vessel, on the confined and related action of which it depends entirely for the direction of its course and the vigour of its movement. End quote. Strength of will is the test of a young man's possibilities. Can he will strong enough and hold whatever he undertakes with an iron grip? It is the iron grip that takes and holds. What chance is there in this crowding, pushy, selfish, greedy world, where everything is pusher or pushed, for a young man with no will, no grip on life? The man who would forge to the front in this competitive age must be a man of prompt and determined decision. A Tailor's Needle. It is in one of Ben Jonson's old plays, quote, when I once take the humour of a thing, I am like your tailor's needle. I go through with it. End quote. This is not different from Richelieu, who said, quote, when I have once taken a resolution, I go straight to my aim. I overthrow all. I cut down all. End quote. And in business affairs, the counsel of Rothschild is to the same effect, quote, do without fail that which you determine to do. End quote. Gladstone's children were taught to accomplish to the end whatever they might begin, no matter how insignificant the undertaking might be. What is worse than rashness? It is irresolution that is worse than rashness. He that shoots, says Feltham, quote, may sometimes hit the mark, but he that shoots not at all can never hit it. Irresolution is like an ague. It shakes not this nor that limb, but all the body is at once in a fit. End quote. The man who is forever twisting and turning, backing and filling, hesitating and dawdling, shuffling and parleying, weighing and balancing, splitting hairs over non-essentials, listening to every new motive which presents itself, will never accomplish anything. But the positive man, the decided man, is a power in the world, and stands for something. You can measure him and estimate the work that his energy will accomplish. Opportunity is coy, is swift, is gone before the slow, the unobservant, the indolent, or the careless can seize her. Vigilance in watching opportunity, said Phelps, quote, tact and daring in seizing upon opportunity, force and persistence in crowding opportunity to its utmost of possible achievement, these are the martial virtues which must command success. End quote. The best men, remarked Chapin, quote, are not those who have waited for chances, but who have taken them, besieged the chance, conquered the chance, and made chance the servitor. End quote. Is it not possible to classify successes and failures by their various degrees of willpower? A man who can resolve vigorously upon a course of action, and turns neither to the right nor to the left, though a paradise tempt him, who keeps his eyes upon the goal, whatever distracts him, is sure of success. Not every vessel that sails from Tarshish will bring back the gold of Ophir. But shall it therefore rot in the harbour? No, give it sails to the wind. Conscious power. Conscious power, says Mellers, quote, exists within the mind of everyone. Sometimes its existence is unrealized, but it is there. It is there to be developed and brought forth, like the culture of that obstinate but beautiful flower, the orchid. To allow it to remain dormant is to place oneself in obscurity, to trample on one's ambition, to smother one's faculties. To develop it is to individualize all that is best within you and give it to the world. It is by an absolute knowledge of yourself, the proper estimate of your own value. End quote. There is hardly a reader, says an experienced educator, quote, who will not be able to recall the early life of at least one young man whose childhood was spent in poverty, and who, in boyhood, expressed a firm desire to secure a higher education. If, a little later, that desire became a declared resolve, soon the avenues opened to that end. That desire and resolve created an atmosphere which attracted the forces necessary to the attainment of the purpose. Many of these young men will tell us that, as long as they were hoping and striving and longing, mountains of difficulty rose before them, but that when they fashioned their hopes into fixed purposes, aid came unsought to help them on the way. End quote. Do you believe in yourself? The man without self-reliance and an iron will is the plaything of chance, the puppet of his environment, the slave of circumstances. Are not doubts the greatest of enemies? If you would succeed up to the limit of your possibilities, must you not constantly hold to the belief that you are success organized, and that you will be successful, no matter what opposes? You are never to allow a shadow of doubt to enter your mind that the Creator intended you to win in life's battle. Regard every suggestion that your life may be a failure, that you are not made like those who succeed, and that success is not for you, as a traitor, and expel it from your mind as you would a thief from your house. There is something sublime in the youth who possesses the spirit of boldness and fearlessness, who has proper confidence in his ability to do and dare. The world takes us at our own valuation. It believes in the man who believes in himself, but it has little use for the timid man, the one who is never certain of himself, who cannot rely on his own judgment, who craves advice from others and is afraid to go ahead on his own account. It is the man with a positive nature, the man who believes that he is equal to the emergency, who believes he can do the thing he attempts, who wins the confidence of his fellow man. He is beloved because he is brave and self-sufficient. Those who have accomplished great things in the world have been, as a rule, bold, aggressive, and self-confident. They dared to step out from the crowd and act in an original way. They were not afraid to be generals. There is little room in this crowding, competing age for the timid, vacillating youth. He who would succeed today must not only be brave, but must also dare to take chances. He who waits for certainty never wins. The law of the soul is eternal endeavour that bears the man onward and upward forever. A man can be too confiding in others, but never too confident in himself. Never admit defeat or poverty. Stoutly assert your divine right to hold your head up and look the world in the face. Step bravely to the front, whatever opposes, and the world will make way for you. No one will insist upon your rights while you yourself doubt that you have any. Believe you were made for the place you fill. Put forth your whole energies. Be awake. Electrify yourself. Go forth to the task. A young man once said to his employer, quote, "Don't give me an easy job. I want to handle heavy boxes, shoulder great loads. I would like to lift a big mountain and throw it into the sea," end quote. And he stretched out two brawny arms, while his honest eyes danced, and his whole being glowed with conscious strength. The world in its heart admires the stern, determined doer. The world turns aside to let any man pass who knows whither he is going. It is wonderful how even the apparent casualties of life seem to bow to a spirit that will not bow to them, and yield to assist a design after having in vain attempted to frustrate it. "The man who succeeds," says Prentice Mulford, quote, "must always in mind or imagination live, move, think, and act as if he gained that success, or he never will gain it," end quote. "We go forth," said Emerson, quote, "austere, dedicated, believing in the iron links of destiny, and will not turn on our heels to save our lives. A book, a bust, or only the sound of a name shoots a spark through the nerves, and we suddenly believe in will. We cannot hear of personal vigour of any kind, great power of performance, without fresh resolution." End quote. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of An Iron Will by Orison Swett Marden, assisted by Abner Bailey. Force of Will in Camp and Field. Oh, what miracles have been wrought by the self-confidence, the self-determination of an iron will! What impossible deeds have been performed by it! It was this that took Napoleon over the Alps in midwinter. It took Farragut and Dewey past the cannons, torpedoes, and mines of the enemy. It led Nelson and Grant to victory. It has been the great tonic in the world of discovery, invention, and art. It has helped to win the thousand triumphs in war and science which were deemed impossible. The secret of Jeanne d'Arc's success was not alone in rare decision of character, but in the seeing of visions which inspired her to self-confidence, confidence in her divine mission. It was an iron will that gave Nelson command of the British fleet, a title and a statue at Trafalgar Square. It was the keynote of his character when he said, "When I don't know whether to fight or not, I always fight." It was an iron will that was brought into play when Horatius, with two companions, held 90,000 Tuscans at bay until the bridge across the Tiber had been destroyed. when Leonidas at Thermopylae checked the mighty march of Xerxes, when Themistocles off the coast of Greece shattered the Persians' armada, when Caesar, finding his army hard-pressed, seized spear and buckler and snatched victory from defeat, when Winkelried gathered to his breast a sheaf of Austrian spears and opened a path for his comrades, when Wellington fought in many climes without ever being conquered, when Ney, on 100 fields, changed apparent disaster into brilliant triumph, when Sheridan arrived from Winchester as the Union retreat was becoming a rout and turned the tide, when Sherman signalled his men to hold the fort, knowing that their leader was coming. History furnishes thousands of examples of men who have seized occasions to accomplish results deemed impossible by those less resolute. Prompt decision and whole-souled action sweep the world before them. Who was the organizer of the modern German Empire? Was he not the man of iron? Napoleon and Grant. What would you do if you were besieged in a place entirely destitute of provisions? Asked the examiner when Napoleon was a cadet. If there were anything to eat in the enemy's camp, I should not be concerned. When Paris was in the hands of a mob and the authorities were panic-stricken, in came a man who said, I know a young officer who can quell this mob. Send for him. Napoleon was sent for. He came. He subjugated the mob. He subjugated the authorities. He ruled France, then conquered Europe. May 10th, 1796, Napoleon carried the bridge at Lodi in the face of the Austrian batteries trained upon the French end of the structure. Behind them were 6,000 troops. Napoleon massed 4,000 grenadiers at the head of the bridge, with a battalion of 300 carbineers in front. At the tap of the drum, the foremost assailants wheeled from the cover of the street wall under a terrible hail of grape and canister and attempted to pass the gateway to the bridge. The front ranks went down like stalks of grain before a reaper. The column staggered and reeled backward, and the valiant grenadiers were appalled by the task before them. Without a word or a look of reproach, Napoleon placed himself at their head, and his aides and generals rushed to his side. Forward again over heaps of dead that choked the passage, and a quick run, counted by seconds only, carried the column across 200 yards of clear space, scarcely a shot from the Austrians taking effect beyond the point where the platoons wheeled for the first leap. The guns of the enemy were not aimed at the advance. The advance was too quick for the Austrian gunners. So sudden and so miraculous was it all that the Austrian artillerists abandoned their guns instantly, and their supports fled in a panic instead of rushing to the front and meeting the French onslaught. This Napoleon had counted on in making the bold attack. What was Napoleon but the thunderbolt of war? He once journeyed from Spain to Paris at 17 miles an hour in the saddle. Is it possible to cross the path? Asked Napoleon of the engineers who had been sent to explore the dreaded pass of St. Bernard. Perhaps, was the hesitating reply, it is within the limits of possibility. Forward, then. Yet Ulysses S. Grant, a young man unknown to fame, with neither money nor influence, with no patrons or friends, in 6 years fought more battles, gained more victories, captured more prisoners, took more spoils, commanded more men than Napoleon did in 20 years. The great thing about him, said Lincoln, is cool persistence. Don't swear, fight. when the Spanish fire on San Juan Hill became almost unbearable, some of the Rough Riders began to swear. Colonel Wood, with the wisdom of a good leader, called out, amid the whistle of the Mauser bullets, "Don't swear, fight!" In a skirmish at Salamanca, while the enemy's guns were pouring shot into his regiment, Sir William Napier's men became disobedient. He at once ordered a halt and flogged four of the ringleaders under fire. The men yielded at once, and then marched 3 miles under a heavy cannonade as coolly as if it were a review. When Pellissier, the Crimean chief of Zouave, struck an officer with a whip, the man drew a pistol that missed fire. The chief replied, "Fellow, I order you a 3 days' arrest for not having your arms in better order." The man of iron will is cool in the hour of danger. I had to run like a cyclone. This was what Roosevelt said about his pushing on up San Juan Hill ahead of his regiment. I had to run like a cyclone to stay in front and keep from being run over. The personal heroism of Hobson or of Cushing, who blew up the Albemarle 40 years ago, was but the expression of a magnificent willpower. It was this which was the basis of General Wheeler's unparalleled military advancement. A second lieutenant at 23, a colonel at 24, a brigadier general at 25, a major general at 26, a corps commander at 27, and a lieutenant general at 28. General Wheeler had 16 horses killed under him, and a great number wounded. His saddle equipments and clothes were frequently struck by the missiles of the enemy. He was 3 times wounded, once painfully. He had 32 staff officers or acting staff officers killed or wounded. In almost every case, they were immediately by his side. No officer was ever more exposed to the missiles of death than Joseph Wheeler. What is this imperial characteristic of manhood, an iron will, but that which underlies all magnificent achievement, whether by heroes of the Light Brigade or the heroic firefighters of our great cities? End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of An Iron Will by Orison Swett Marden, assisted by Abner Bailey. Willpower in its relation to health and disease. 1. There is no doubt that, as a rule, great decision of character is usually accompanied by great constitutional firmness. Men who have been noted for great firmness of character have usually been strong and robust. As a rule, it is the strong physical man who carries weight and conviction. Take as an example William the Conqueror, as he is pictured by Green in his history. Quote, "The very spirit of the sea-robbers from whom he sprang seemed embodied in his gigantic form, his enormous strength, his savage countenance, his desperate bravery. No other knight under heaven, his enemies confessed, was William's peer. No other man could bend William's bow. His mace crashed through a ring of English warriors to the foot of the standard. He rose to his greatest heights in moments when other men despaired. No other man who ever sat upon the throne of England was this man's match." End quote. Or take Webster. Sidney Smith said, quote, "Webster is a living lie, because no man on earth can be as great as he looks." End quote. Carlyle said of him, quote, "One would incline at sight to back him against the world." End quote. His very physique was eloquent. Men yielded their wills to his at sight. The great prizes of life ever fall to the robust, the stalwart, the strong. Not to a huge muscle or powerful frame, necessarily, but to a strong vitality, a great nervous energy. It is the Lord Brougham's, working almost continuously 144 hours. It is the Napoleon's, 20 hours in the saddle. It is the Franklin's, camping out in the open air at 70. It is the Gladstone's, firmly grasping the helm of the ship of state at 84, tramping miles every day and chopping down huge trees at 85, who accomplish the great things of life. To prosper, you must improve your brain power, and nothing helps the brain more than a healthy body. The race of today is only to be won by those who will study to keep their bodies in such good condition that their minds are able and ready to sustain that high pressure on memory and mind which our present fierce competition engenders. It is health rather than strength that is now wanted. Health is essentially the requirement of our time to enable us to succeed in life. In all modern occupations, from the nursery to the school, from the school to the shop or world beyond, the brain and nerve strain go on, continuous, augmenting and intensifying. As a rule, physical vigour is the condition of a great career. Stonewall Jackson, early in life, determined to conquer every weakness he had, physical, mental and moral. He held all of his powers with a firm hand. To his great self-discipline and self-mastery he owed his success. So determined was he to harden himself to the weather that he could not be induced to wear an overcoat in winter. "I will not give in to the cold," he said. For a year, on account of dyspepsia, he lived on buttermilk and stale bread, and wore a wet shirt next his body because his doctor advised it, although everybody else ridiculed the idea. This was while he was professor at the Virginia Military Institute. His doctor advised him to retire at 9 o'clock, and no matter where he was or who was present, he always sought his bed on the minute. He adhered rigidly through life to this stern system of discipline. Such self-training, such self-conquest, gives one great power over others. It is equal to genius itself. "I can do nothing," said Grant, "without 9 hours' sleep." What else is so grand as to stand on life's threshold, fresh, young, hopeful, with a consciousness of power equal to any emergency, a master of the situation? The glory of a young man is his strength. Our great need of the world today is for men and women who are good animals, to endure the strain of our concentrated civilization. The coming man and woman must have an excess of animal spirits. They must have a robustness of health. Mere absence of disease is not health. It is the overflowing fountain, not the one half full, that gives life and beauty to the valley below. Only he is healthy who exults in mere animal existence, whose very life is a luxury, who feels a bounding pulse throughout his body, who feels life in every limb, as dogs do when scouring over the field, or as boys do when gliding over fields of ice. 2. Yet, in spite of all this, in defiance of it, we know that an iron will is often triumphant in the contest with physical infirmity. Quote, "Brave spirits are a balsam to themselves. There is a nobleness of mind that heals wounds beyond salves." End quote. "One day," said a noted rope-walker, quote, "I signed an agreement to wheel a barrow along a rope on a given day. A day or two before, I was seized with lumbago. I called in my medical man and told him I must be cured by a certain day, not only because I should lose what I hoped to earn, but also forfeit a large sum. I got no better, and the doctor forbade my getting up. I told him, 'What do I want with your advice?
if you cannot cure me, of what good is your advice? When I got to the place, there was the doctor protesting I was unfit for the exploit. I went on, though I felt like a frog with my back. I got ready my pole and my barrow, took hold of the handles, and wheeled it along the rope as well as I ever did. When I got to the end, I wheeled it back again, and when this was done, I was a frog again. What made me that I could wheel the barrow? It was my reserve will. End quote. What does he know, asks the sage, who has not suffered? End quote. Did not Schiller produce his greatest tragedies in the midst of physical suffering almost amounting to torture? Handel was never greater than when, warned by palsy of the approach of death and struggling with distress and suffering, he sat down to compose the great works which have made his name immortal in music. Beethoven was almost totally deaf and burdened with sorrow when he produced his greatest works. Milton, writing, "Who best can suffer, best can do," wrote at his best when in feeble health and when poor and blind. Quote, "Yet I argue not against heaven's hand or will, nor bate a jot of heart or hope, but still bear up and steer right onward." End quote. The Reverend William H. Milburn, who lost his sight when a child, studied for the ministry and was ordained before he attained his majority. He has written half a dozen books, among them a very careful history of the Mississippi Valley. He has long been chaplain of the lower house of Congress. Blind Fanny Crosby of New York was a teacher of the blind for many years. She has written nearly 3,000 hymns, among which are "Pass Me Not, O Gentle Saviour," "Rescue the Perishing," "Saviour More Than Life to Me," and "Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross." "The truest help we can render one who is afflicted," said Bishop Brooks, quote, "is not to take his burden from him, but to call out his best energy, that he may be able to bear." End quote. What a mighty will Darwin had! He was in continual ill health. He was in constant suffering. His patience was marvellous. No one but his wife knew what he endured. For 40 years,